So I know what you were just thinking. Let me try this and see if this is what just happened. Emily stood and she started reading the scripture. And you heard there was a man going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. And your mind said, oh, I know that one, and flipped off. I've heard that one before. I don't need to listen. That's what happens with these really familiar stories. And there's hardly a story more familiar than this, right? We hear the first words and we think, oh, I know what that's about. And we stop listening. Well, let's work on that story because it may not be the story you thought you knew. In the first place, the title we've given it over the centuries, Good Samaritan, is an oxymoron. There is no such thing as a Good Samaritan. In the context of Jesus' world, the only Good Samaritan was a dead Samaritan, okay? And so that does not describe the story at all. The story is a story in answer to a question, right? A very highly educated religious lawyer comes to Jesus and asks, what must I have? What must I do to have eternal life? It is the kind of question you would ask a rabbi, and you would hang on his answer. But Jesus doesn't answer it. He knows that this highly educated religious lawyer already knows the answer. He may just be asking it to see if Jesus is going to give the answer he already knows. So Jesus says, what does it say in the Bible? We could all say it together, couldn't we? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus says, that's right. You got the right answer. Doesn't it feel great to get the right answer? Unfortunately, that's not enough. Just getting the right answer doesn't do it. So, this religious lawyer, this highly educated individual, this person who, frighteningly enough, is very much like me, ask, who is my neighbor? Whose life matters? That's what he's asking. We've had a lot of conversation around that recently, haven't we? Do black lives matter? Do blue lives matter? Can we just say, oh, all lives matter, and just leave it at that? It's interesting that, again, Jesus doesn't give an answer. He gives a story. And in that story, the good guys turn into people whose lives and whose actions testify to the fact that all lives do not matter, and we all know that is true. There are some lives in our culture that do matter and some lives that don't. And we know who those people are, don't we? And those good religious folk gave testimony to that. They had good reasons. Oh, they had great, they had the best reasons for passing by on the other side and saying, that man lying in the ditch, who is never identified by ethnicity or religion or race, he's just a certain man in the story. They have every good reason to say, couldn't be my neighbor, his life doesn't matter. And then along comes a Samaritan. Today that might be a Muslim. Today that might be an immigrant from Syria. Today that might be anybody you would rather lay in the ditch and die than have touch you. I don't know who that is for you, but that's who the Samaritan is. And he becomes not simply the hero of a story. He becomes the exemplar and teacher of how we do what God has commanded us to do, which is love God and love our neighbor as ourselves. It is from the other, the adversary, the enemy, that we begin to learn what God requires of us. I really never heard that story in a rendition that captured this understanding until I read the Cotton Patch Gospels. You know, we're doing a production. It'll be coming up on the fourth floor, not too long from now. Clarence Jordan, who had his doctorate in Greek, was a Southern Baptist preacher who actually believed that he ought to do what Jesus told him to do, and so founded an interracial community in America's Georgia when people would burn down your houses and kill you for doing that. Told a rendition of this story that had a white motorist stranded on the roadside, beaten up and harmed, and it was an African-American truck driver who stopped to help him. Now, in those days, that was a radical interpretation. Actually, after this week, it still might be a radical interpretation. And then I realized that that was not the first time I had heard this story told with that kind of understanding. But I hadn't known it at the time. Many of you know that my matron saint of storytelling is my great aunt Minerva. Up in Stewart County, we sat on a porch and she told me stories and sang me songs. And some of those stories were family stories, and some of those stories were folk tales, and some of those stories had come across from the British Isles as songs. And there was one that she told me that I always assumed was a folk tale. It was about the early settlement of that region, that part of northern Middle Tennessee that borders Kentucky. It was about a long hunter who came across the mountains from the Carolinas year after year after year hunting, because that area was a hunting ground for the native tribes that surrounded this part of Tennessee, now Tennessee and Kentucky, and also the Europeans who came across. They would hunt during the good weather, and they would go back to a settlement ordinarily during the winters. But this particular long hunter decided he wanted to find a way to winter there in Stewart County. And so he built a little insubstantial shack called a lean-to. It's called that because it won't stand up by itself. It has to lean up against something, either a tree trunk or a dirt bank or something. But every year he made that a little more substantial. One year he cut holes in it and then made shutters the next year to open and close those windows. He had a doorway, but he had no door until one year, my auntie said, that he carried a door on his back all the way across the mountain, just so he could have a real door for his little house. Now, he neglected to bring any hardware to attach it to the door frame or to act as a latch, so he took what he had. He was a hunter. He took skins. And with hide, he created hinges to attach the door to the door frame. And with a string of leather, he created a latch. He could pile stones in the corner of his little one-room shack, and with a hole in the ceiling, he could build a fire on the stones. The smoke would go out the hole. He could stay nice and warm. One winter evening, just about dark, the wind picked up, and it was a cold wind. Pretty soon, it began to snow, and before you know it, that snow was coming so fast and furious you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. Well, the long hunter wasn't worried. He just made sure his shutters were shut tightly, his door was shut, made sure his fire was burning brightly and there was plenty of wood to add to it through the night. He settled in to weather the storm, went to sleep. And deep in the night, he was awakened by a scuttling sound outside and a banging at the door. He had no idea there was another human being for miles around. In fact, didn't know if this was a human being, because sometimes wild animals would try to get shelter inside in storms like this. So he took his long rifle down from the pegs on which it hung, undid the string that served as a latch, opened the door with the barrel of his long rifle, and there framed in the doorway stood a native of that region, a Cherokee. Now, the Cherokee didn't speak English, and the long hunter didn't speak Cherokee, but they both knew what the visitor wanted. He was out in the storm. He needed a place to come inside. Otherwise, he was liable to freeze to death. And I'll never forget, my auntie always couched the long hunter's reply not only in the same words, but in the same tune. She said he looked out that door and he said, "Be gone, you Indian dog." And he shut the door against the man, expecting him to go out into the storm and freeze. Several years later, though, the long hunter on Christmas Eve was out hunting some distance from his little shack, and darkness came more quickly than he expected, and with the darkness it began to snow. The wind picked up, and pretty soon that snow, swirled by the wind, came so fast and furious you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. Well, now it was the long hunter's turn to be in trouble. He couldn't find a path he recognized. He couldn't find a landmark that he knew in the driving snow. He knew he had to find some place to weather the storm, and finally came upon an old dead tree that had been partially hollowed out. So he dug with his hands as much of that pulpy inside as he could out of the tree, got into the husk of that tree, wrapped himself around himself, hoping that his own body heat would keep him alive through the night. And he fought sleep as long as he could because he thought he remembered hearing somewhere that when you freeze to death, you just go to sleep and never wake up. But after a while, sleep overcame him and everything went dark. And when he awoke, it was still dark, but he was no longer in the tree and he was no longer wrapped up in himself. He was stretched out in a dwelling made of sticks and skins and twigs, and as his eyes adjusted to the light, he noticed there was a tiny fire in the middle of this dwelling, and as he looked across the fire, a face emerged from the other side. It was the face of that very same Indian dog he had sent from his door several years before, who had apparently found him in the tree, believed that his life mattered, lifted him out, carried him to his own dwelling place, and gave him the best Christmas present he ever received. That was just one of my auntie's stories. I'm not sure she ever connected it to the Good Samaritan story, but it's exactly the same story. Because, you know, when I started in school and I started reading about Tennessee history, I did not find one single story that had a Cherokee as the hero, or any native tribe individual as the hero. No, we were Europeans bringing light to a dark continent. We were bringing civilization to a savage land. And I wondered, where in the world could my auntie have found that particular story? I was past 40 years old when I learned the rest of the story. It all has to do with a man named Bradley Self. Now, every time he was spoken of in my family, he always had a prefix attached to his name. He was called that old Bradley Self. When I got old enough to hear the explanation, I realized that he was spoken of with such disdain because Bradley Self had two wives, not in succession, but at the same time, in the same household. He had children with both. The two wives were sisters. Now, the good folks in Stewart County, the Baptist and the Methodist and the Church of Christ folk, had no experience of this kind of living arrangement. Now, they had read about the law of levirate marriage in the Hebrew Bible, and they knew that under that system, if your brother died, you took his wife into your household, and you had children with her, so his name could continue. But they were pretty sure they were not Old Testament Hebrews. What they didn't realize was that there was a fairly similar system among the Cherokee people, and that Bradley Self and both of his wives, the Taylor sisters, were Cherokee. What I wasn't told until I was past 40 years of age is that Bradley Self was also my great-great-grandfather. My auntie's mother was the daughter of Bradley Self and the older of the two Taylor sisters, whose name, interestingly enough, was Elizabeth Taylor. So I think I finally learned where my auntie heard that story. I think she heard it from her mother, and it wasn't a folk tale at all. It was something that actually happened. And it was a story about who our neighbor is. Because you see, as a kid who grew up going to movies with cowboys and Indians and thinking he knew which side he was on, it put me in something of a dilemma. Because after hearing that story, I had a foot in each world. And those who my culture had defined as enemy were now part of the family. They were not just neighbors, they were kin. And isn't that what Jesus is about? Isn't that what this story is about? How can we be so afraid of someone we're going to shoot them if they're kin? How can we be so angry at someone that we will sit and wait for them and pick them off and take their life if they're kin? Who is my neighbor? Anyone who needs our help is our neighbor and our family member. Whose life matters? It's not enough to say everybody's life matters, because we know that historically some lives have not mattered. And we need to name those. Just like Jesus named the Samaritan. Because you see, those folks we think whose lives don't matter, according to Jesus, they become our teachers. They are the ones who instruct us on what God requires and how we live that out. And they not only cease to be enemy, they not only cease to be adversary. In Jesus' story, they become teacher and neighbor and kinfolks for all of us. Thanks be to God.